Since 1936, the National Wildlife Federation has worked with hunters and anglers to pass the most important conservation laws in American history and to protect our sporting traditions. This podcast explores our history, our values, and the work we do to safeguard the fish and wildlife that fuel our passions. We are NWF Outdoors.
The NWF Outdoors Podcast is brought to you by Hunt to Eat, an inclusive hunting apparel company with a focus on community, real food, and conservation. Check out Hunt to Eat's NWF line, wild game recipes, and hunting and fishing designs at hunttoeat.com, and enter the code WILDLIFE10 to get 10% off your order.
Welcome to the NWF Outdoors Podcast, everybody. This is your host, Aaron Kindle. I am without my co-host today, Drew Youngdyke. He is otherwise disposed today, but I am happy to welcome three different guests today. Today we have Roman Dial with us, and he is a professor in Alaska. We have Paul Forward, who is a doctor in Alaska, and Tom, tell me how you say your last name. I'm afraid I'll butcher it.
No, it's Tom Loheis.
Tom Loheis, and I'll give you their bios in a second, but how's everybody doing today?
Doing well. Thanks, Aaron.
Doing great.
Good morning, Aaron. Good morning, Paul, Roman.
Good. Well, thanks for joining us. The reason we're here in a lot of ways is we were connected by a mutual friend to talk about sheep hunting in Alaska largely and a lot of the ancillary issues around that, you know, the logistics and how you get there and what's happening with sheep in Alaska and so on. So I'm really excited. I keep feeling like I'm luckier and luckier all the time with these podcasts. We keep getting really interesting guests. We keep getting, you know, inquiries about really awesome issues. And this one luckily just kind of landed on our lap and we were able to make it happen really quickly. So thank you all for joining. And I'll say one other thing, as our listeners know, I'm here in Colorado. We have about 600,000 or 700,000 acres of wildfire burning in our state right now because of incredible winds. While I don't have any wildfire right next to me here, luckily, we do have a lot of high wind. So I'm going to ask you to forgive me if you hear wind noise. But we'll get going here. Let's just, I'm going to give quick bios and then we'll talk about what we've been doing outside here. So first we'll go with Paul. Paul grew up in Eagle River, Alaska, and currently lives in Girdwood, Alaska. He is a doctor at the hospital and emergency room in the Arctic community of Kotzebue. Is that correct, Paul? Am I saying it right?
Kotzebue. Yeah.
And he's also worked for the past 9 winters as a full-time heli ski guide in the Kugach Mountains. Is that correct, too?
Chugach.
I'm going to have trouble with a lot of Alaska pronunciations, I think, today, but we'll keep going. Spent his life chasing deep snow and whitewater kayaking in the summer and got into traditional bow hunting and took his first big game animal when he was 12 years old. A moose, which is incredible. My son down here in Colorado is always talking about when we'll ever be able to get a chance to get a moose because you need about 20 points. We've got him started. He's got 3 or 4. He's 15, so maybe one day.
Awesome.
And he also says, Paul says that his favorite pastime is spending as much time as possible with his wife, Erin, and his son, Ren. So thanks for being here, Paul.
Thank you.
And then we have Roman Dial. He's a professor of mathematics and biology at Alaska Pacific University. He's been exploring the Alaskan wilderness for the past 40 years or so. And he's an author. He's written 2 books. One is called Pack Rafting, an Introduction and How-To Guide, and another called The Adventurer's Son. Welcome, Roman. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aaron.
And then last, we're lucky to have Tom Loheis. I keep butchering that, Tom. I apologize. No worries. He's a sheep research biologist for Alaska Fish and Game. He grew up like me in Wyoming, in western Wyoming, chasing elk and mule deer. And that's the reasons he became a biologist. He's got a master's degree and PhD from University of Wyoming. Go Pokes. He has a research background in physiology, nutrition, and metabolism. In wildlife biology, and he's worked on Dall sheep since 2008 and has also done some work on moose, black bears, and several other species. So welcome to you as well, Tom.
Thanks, Aaron.
And let's just kick it off here. What have you all been doing outside? Let's start with Paul. What have you been doing? Our tradition is to talk just for a few seconds about what in the heck we've been doing outside, since that's really what brings us all here.
October is always a little bit of a tough month, but I've been biking, mountain biking, whitewater kayaking a little bit. And yesterday I was out grouse hunting and heading out deer hunting here soon.
Sounds great. Tom, you want to jump in next?
Yeah, like Paul said, October's a little bit difficult. Most of our hunting seasons are closed, so I'll reflect on what happened previous to that. And I was fortunate enough to go on three separate sheep hunts this year, one with my 13-year-old son, and then two with two real good friends, and helped them both take their first sheep. It was a real, real neat experience to be involved with. And I ended up spending most of August and September just outside, living out of a backpack.
That's fantastic. I'm sure we can get into those a little bit more. Roman, how about you? What have you been up to?
You know, I'm teaching pretty much full time. I feel like I'm just sitting on my butt zooming all day, but I'm lucky if I get my dog out for a walk. But in September, I went on a moose hunt and a caribou hunt. And then I spent a lot of time in the Brooks Range hunting for white spruce trees that shouldn't be where they were.
Wow. Maybe we can talk about that as well. Well, awesome. You guys obviously spend a lot of time outside. Our listeners know we actually just recorded a podcast just yesterday. So it's going to be very similar to me. I've been out elk hunting a little this year and got a friend who'd never hunted before, who helped him get a cow the other week. And then I'm leaving after this to take my son out to get his elk this year, hopefully. And we got a big snowstorm coming in. So timing is good.
Perfect.
Well, let's just jump in here. Is it fair for me to say that wild sheep is what connects the three of you? I mean, from hunting and researching and you know, somehow you all found one another. Maybe just talk us through that a little bit. Whoever wants to take that one.
So I think mostly it's love of wild places, including hunting. Like I know Roman from some pack rafting adventures in the whitewater community. And I met Tom, I think, for the first time regarding sheep hunting. I think he gave me some advice on a tag my wife had drawn, and we got along real well. And he was had some fascinating things to say about some of the things we're going to talk about today regarding climate change and wild sheep, and especially in the Chugach close to home.
Excellent. What do you all want to add to that, Tom and Roman?
Well, Roman, I think Roman's kind of the gel that holds us all together. I had started off doing sheep research in the Chugach in 2008, 2009, and had come up with some real interesting information, which we can talk about in a little bit. The long story short is that we found real skinny sheep. And I was looking at the causes for that. Roman approached me at a scientific meeting and just said, hey, some of the work I've been doing, I don't want to steal his thunder here, but so some of the work I've been doing suggests that maybe we're seeing alpine tundra converted into other habitats. Do you think that could be related? And everything just sort of took off from there. We ended up sharing a graduate student, kicking ideas back and forth. And Alaska is unique because it's such a small community. You're always connected to lots of other people in different ways that you discover after you start speaking with them. So mutual friends and mutual adventures and shared stories and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, last time I saw Paul, you know, I think it was the last time we saw each other, it was in Kotzebue, and I was traveling. I guess I was leaving Kotzebue, and Kotzebue is up in the far northwest part of the state, like right on the Chukchi Sea up north above the Arctic Circle. And it's at the end of the Brooks Range. And I was in the Brooks Range looking for spruce trees. And he was there doing his emergency room work. And I was all excited about some of the things that I'd been seeing there. And I knew Paul from, like he said, pack rafting trips. And he's just a super smart guy who's fun to talk to and really a good conversationalist. So I was excited to share with him some of the things I just discovered, and he was enthusiastic to hear about them.
Great. Well, you know, Alaska holds such a kind of a romanticized place in most people's mind. I think those of us who haven't spent much time there or, you know, just think about wild places and wild critters really love to think about Alaska and, you know, the last frontier, as they say. But, you know, you three obviously have a lot of experience there. And I hope what we can do today is just talk a little bit about Alaska and what's happening there and what, you know, what it's like for sportsmen and women that are up there and what are they observing, and maybe wrap that around this, some of the sheep hunts you've done. And I know, Paul, you wanted to talk a little bit about one of your hunts recently, and the three of you have been connected through hunting. So why don't we just kick it off a little bit with, you know, kind of the things we're seeing in Alaska as they relate to sheep, and we'll go from there. You want to fire it off, Roman?
Sure. Yeah, I'll go. Paul, I know I'm older than Paul. He's a young guy. And I was just trying to decide if I'd been in Alaska longer than Paul had been. But how old are you, Paul?
41.
41. So, yep, almost. I can say I've been in the Alaska outdoors longer than Paul has, even though he was sort of born and raised here. And I'm 60. And I, you know, moved to Alaska because I'd come up here as a kid and I love Alaska. It's just, if you're an outdoors person, it's the most fantastic place in the world. And so I started, you know, kicking around the wilderness 40 years ago. And I went to graduate school about 30 years ago, and I heard this idea of climate change, and people would ask me about it. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think it's really happening. You know, maybe it is, you know, the glaciers are receding, but it hadn't really kicked into full swing. And then just in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years now, you can't miss it. It's just such a significant effect, and it affects everything. You know, if you live up here, in the farther north you go, the more it affects.
And that leads very nicely into why I'm here doing what I'm doing for the Department of Fish and Game. I was hired to work on moose with the department in 2002, moved to Alaska from Wyoming after graduate school. And then in 2008, the department determined that there was a need to hire a sheep research biologist. I have a background in mountain travel and climbing, and that combined with a completely new species that had very little work done on it was super exciting. But to put it into context, we've seen population declines in sheep between 20 and 40, almost 50% in some mountain ranges between the late 1990s and then the early 2000s. So when I came on the scene as a researcher, I was tasked with kind of trying to get a better handle on what are the factors driving sheep populations across South Central Alaska.
Excellent. And let's talk a little bit more about that, meaning that, you know, what are the factors? What you talk about sheep decline and kind of walk us through that a little bit. And then secondly, let's illuminate exactly what species of sheep we're talking about. There's several. And I think you mean Dall up there. But just for our listeners, clarify for me.
Yeah, you bet. It is Dall's sheep. It's one of two species of thin-horned sheep in North America. The other one, of course, is the Stones. They're native to northern British Columbia, but they're white sheep, and they're not they're a real different animal than bighorns that some of the hunters and outdoor enthusiasts in the lower 48 might encounter. I've been privileged to catch and handle a few bighorn sheep with a couple of agencies, Wyoming Game and Fish. And they're very, very different from Dall's. Dall's are slender and much more, they're much lighter boned. You know, they're an adult ram here will be 180 to 225 pounds and maybe half again that much in bighorn herds.
Wow. So, and then, you know, I know, Paul, we wanted to touch on your hunt, and I'd like to kind of weave in, you know, as a hunter, and as someone who gets out there on the landscape and goes after these critters, talk about what you're experiencing as far as it relates to what Tom talked about there a little, you know, population declines. Does that make it more difficult to get a tag? You know, walk through what it's like if you're a guy trying to get a Dall sheep tag and what the factors are that weigh into that.
Like Roman said, I mean, I'm pretty young in the grand picture, and I don't I wasn't around like in the golden era of sheep hunting, I don't think, but I shot my first doll ram when I was, I think, 14. I lived in Eagle River and I drew a tag for up the valley from my parents' house, just literally like 10 miles away. And, you know, there were a lot. I mean, we'd see sheep behind the house constantly back then. There were a lot of sheep in the hunting area. I mean, enough sheep that a 14-year-old, my 12-year-old brother, and our like 20-year-old friend who didn't really know what we were doing, my dad was out of town, were able to like shoot a pretty nice old ram. I actually had my bow with me too, but didn't get to use it. But just like anecdotally, there seems like a lot fewer sheep around that area than there used to be. And I think the Tom could speak to this better, but I think the availability of even the lottery tags has decreased quite a bit for the Chugach. Like there used to be, correct me if I'm wrong here, Tom, but I think there used to be a lot more tags available for the Chugach, like back in the 90s and early 2000s, which is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's correct, Paul. And as a matter of fact, we can look at some specific population numbers too. That game management unit real close to Anchorage was hovering at a stable population of about 900 to 1100 sheep through the 1970s and 1980s, and then boomed and hit 22 to 2400, probably about that time you were talking about, early 2000s, and has since dropped back down, hit a bottom of around 900 in 2009, 2010, and has since come back off the bottom a little bit. We're sitting pretty stable, 1300, 1400 sheep in this unit, but we're certainly down off the peak.
Yeah. So Aaron, to continue that conversation about availability of hunting. So what Tom and I are talking about is the Chugach range, which is close to Anchorage. And then so for the most part, that area is accessed for hunting via a lottery where you put in your name basically in December and you get a drawing, and that's the opportunities to hunt in the Chugach. And some of those are, we're talking like single digit percentage, like low single digits or even lower. So some of them are kind of like, if you're lucky, once in a lifetime draws. And then a lot of the other parts of the state, like the Wrangells and the Talkeetnas and the Alaska Range and the Brooks Range, and to lesser degree, the Kenai Mountains, have general harvest tags. So if you're an Alaskan resident, you can just get an over-the-counter tag and go hunting sheep every year. And that's for a legal ram, which is a mature sheep, which is 8 years or older, or has the horns that make a full curl. And so that's kind of the big picture overlay of sheep hunting opportunities in the state.
That's interesting. And so what does doll sheep taste like? I guess just a real simple question. I've never had doll sheep. Talk about how good it is. What do you do? How do you cook it? What do you do with it?
Oh man, I'll go first. I'm sure Tom has some ideas, and Roman too. We probably all are a little biased because we worked hard to get it, so it tastes maybe a little better. But I think it's the best eating meat I've ever had in my life. It has very little game flavor of any kind. It's typically quite tender, even when you're dealing with like an 11 or older year old ram, and it's just awesome. I think like, again, there's some cognitive bias there based on the experience, but like sheep ribs cooked over an open fire with a little salt and pepper and garlic is just like the finest meal a person could ever eat.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up eating elk and cow elk is pretty much top of my scale. Nice September, October cow is about the top of the heap as far as game meat gets, but I put sheep right up there with it.
Yeah. My favorite's bison. I like buffalo most, you know, and plus it's big, it's bigger than a moose and it tastes better than an elk. Elk's close second. And I poo poo sheep cause it's too much work. But as far as because it's a lot of work, it makes it taste better. You know, not completely true, because goat also takes a lot of work, but doesn't taste as good as sheep, in my opinion. And, you know, I haven't eaten nearly as much game meat as these guys, but I kind of think of, you know, sheep meat is a little bit darker than than goat meat. Goat meat seems to be a little bit lighter in color, but yeah, sheep meat is basically the best, but it's just sort of like a treat. It's like a chocolate, you know, it's not like a big meal. You know, you don't get to eat, you could eat all your sheep up in a couple of weeks, I suspect, if you're like a big meat eater. So you kind of save it for a treat.
I'd agree with that. I just want to point out that Roman, who's talking about how sheep is a lot of effort, is probably the person who's covered more ground on foot in Alaska than almost any person alive, including some of the most rugged terrain out there. I think he's probably giving sheep hunters a little too much credit.
Well, that's maybe a good segue, Roman, is to talk about the nexus of you in this work. You know, a professor of mathematics and biology, like where do you come in here? Where on the sheep picture?
Well, you know, my work was that drew me to Tom was that, you know, I'd heard that sheep were disappearing in the game management unit next to Anchorage. And then I'd been studying shrubs, you know, bushes like alders and willows, looking at repeat photography. I had a grad student who was looking at that and they were moving uphill like remarkably fast. You know, like, I mean, if I gave you the number, you wouldn't believe me. It's hard for me to even say it in public, but like 3 feet a year, which is like almost unbelievable that the shrubs would be moving uphill. And, you know, and I've been hiking around Alaska for a long time. And when I would complain to the younger folk that I thought that the shrubs were getting thicker, they would just tell me I was getting older, you know, like, oh, Roman, you're just getting softer. The shrubs aren't really getting any worse. The bushes aren't any worse. But sure enough, when I looked at this aerial photography, they were getting thicker. And I was drawn to, I don't know how I found, I guess I heard in the paper because Tom, I think what happened is Tom would talk to people, the public about sheep, because sheep are really the coolest. I mean, I'd say they're pretty much the coolest thing you can hunt in the state, you know, like a bison would be cooler, but they're so hard to get a hold of. And sheep has the whole package. You know, it's a big wilderness experience. It's a tough hunt. The meat tastes great. You know, it's a real challenge. It's at the hardest time of the year in the Alaska range. You often have to fly in to go sheep hunting. And if you don't fly in and you're hiking in, then you're a super badass. So, so sheep is like at the top of the pile. So everybody, even if you're not a sheep hunter, you're listening to sheep hunters talk about sheep hunting. And then everybody's like, where are the sheep going? And so, you know, that kind of led me to hear, I heard something that Tom had said that he, you know, had heard something that I had said about the shrub. So I had to talk to Tom and say, you know, Tom, the shrubs are moving and maybe it's affecting the sheep. And so we got together and we had a graduate student we just finished up, who found that, you know, when he put GPS collars on these sheep, that the habitat that they were hanging out in was a habitat that was threatened by changing climate and changing climate in two ways. One, believe it or not, it is getting warmer in Alaska, but it's also getting snowier in the winter. Like we have really dry winters now, you know, at the low elevations, it's because it's kind of warm, but at the upper elevations, the snow is getting deeper. At least that's what, you know, my skiing friends tell me. And I also have heard it from some scientists or read the papers where they went up to one of the highest mountains in Alaska and they drilled down at 14,000 feet through the glacier snow at the top of the mountain. And they found that the snow is getting deeper up high. And so deep snow is not very favorable to sheep. I'll let Tom talk more about that. So I think that climate change, both between warming and getting snowier, is affecting the sheep.
Absolutely. You know, Roman, that's a really good point. And sheep are extremely well adapted. I mean, they've lived in dry, windy, cold climates for 40,000 years, and they're supremely adapted to dealing with cold. They're really well insulated and you know, they can forage on just little bits and pieces of grass coming up through the snowpack. But what they can't deal with is deep, heavy, wet snow. And they can crater, they can dig through the snow to forage. But when that snow becomes heavy, wet, and dense, they're unable to dig through it. So that challenges them in one way. And then what you pointed out with shrub and tree line advancing up into the tundra, you're actually seeing alpine tundra, sheep, you know, textbook sheep habitat, converted, they're grazers, right? The grasses and sedges are a primary food item. So when you see alders and willow move up into tundra meadow, you're essentially losing sedges and grass and some of the leafy green stuff that they prefer. So you're seeing a difficulty in winter habitat accessing food. You're seeing a lack of summer habitat.
That's pretty fascinating. So, you know, it sounds like these changes are happening pretty fast in a lot of ways. I mean, if you're talking about 3 feet a year movement on shrubs and alders and so on and other conversion, I mean, what was it like? What did the sheep do about that? Did they simply, you know, struggle? You know, a lot of species, you know, I know here in Colorado, some of the things like, you know, are moving up higher because there's still a little bit more to access or other things like that. What are the adaptations that the sheep are trying to do to survive these changes?
Well, here we're not seeing the altitude. We see an altitudinal movement just during the course of the year. They tend to move up and down to follow green up, but they can only go so high. You know, above tundra, you don't have much other than ice and rock. So we're not seeing that rock. That rock doesn't magically become tundra when the alders grow into the lower end of the tundra. So their habitat is shrinking. And what we see, you know, my data in the Chugach shows that pregnancy rates are lower than you might expect and animals are skinnier than you might expect. To put some numbers to it, what you usually see is 85 to 95% of the adult females in an ungulate population, elk, moose, deer, sheep, will be pregnant. And some of the Chugach data we've looked at shows that pregnancy rates in most years are in that range, but every couple of years you have an excursion down into the low double digits. I've documented pregnancy rates as low as 18 and 21% in a couple of years in the Chugach. So I think to answer your question, what they're doing is they're responding by having fewer offspring.
Wow, that's interesting. I think, you know, it's always troublesome for us who appreciate wildlife so much to hear about species having trouble. Is there something that's being done? Are researchers or the agencies, are they doing things to address these issues with sheep or just researching it right now? Or tell me kind of about that trajectory of kind of knowing it and then addressing it.
Well, we're still very much in the knowing it stage and explaining what's going on, I think, is the first step. But that's a great question. And I get asked that a lot. It's like, what do we do? And at this point, you know, I think we adapt to a lower population level, and we know that there won't be as many animals on the landscape. and then as far as long-term in the future, I don't have a good answer to that. You know, it appears that population numbers have stabilized. They're not in free fall. It's important to communicate that to folks, but we're certainly existing at a lower level than we experienced 20, 30 years ago.
Well, one thing I'd like to mention, just as, you know, I'm not a sheep expert, but in the little bit of reading Tom and I shared this grad student named Kyle, and so I kind of had to keep up with Kyle. And Kyle is this young guy from Wisconsin who moved to Alaska, and he jumps out of helicopters wearing cowboy boots and a big hat and wrestles sheep to the ground and puts GPS collars on them. And he's an expert hunter too, and he's taught me a lot about sheep behavior, for example. And so the ewe needs to stay near the cliff so she can run up the mountain cliff to get her lamb to safety away from like wolves and bears and eagles and such. And so that forces her to overgraze, and all the ewes to overgraze the little bit of pasture that's good right at the base of the cliffs. And then it's already overgrazed, and then the shrubs are moving in. And the problem with sheep is they don't do anything unless they're following somebody else, and they're resistant. They're really resistant to moving. I think Tom pointed out in some time that a lot of sheep die in avalanches, and mountain terrain is dangerous. And so sheep tend to stay in local areas that they know are safe, and they're really not going to leave that area until things are really bad. They got to be like in thick brush, and all the food's got to be gone, and all the snow has to be burying all their winter range before they leave. And so their population is going to get pretty low before the big ram leads them away. And I, you know, I'm simplifying it. You know, this is just sort of like a layman's version of sheep behavior and ecology. But I would say, and I'm not a sheep biologist and I'm not a sheep manager, but if we were able to identify good sheep habitat, kind of like where they could be, but they haven't got to yet, then we could move them there. Just like, you know, we moved animals around the state. Just recently we moved wood bison or wood buffalo, an animal from, you know, Canada that used to live in Alaska, and we moved it out to the lower Yukon, and they're doing pretty well. I think they're wandering around. So if we wanted to, I feel, don't you think, Tom, we could move sheep to a better habitat if we could define it, or is that not something we'd want to do?
Possibly. That's sort of a, there's a lot of layers to that conversation. And the big hiccup right now is disease, which is a concern, disease transmission, either across or within sheep ranges. So we're hesitant to use that as an option, but maybe a different way to look at it would be to see if there's areas within the same mountain range where the same that were historically used that aren't currently being utilized.
Can you dive into that a little bit more, Tom? You know, National Wildlife Federation, where I work, we have a wildlife conflict resolution program, and a lot of the work we do in that is to try and stop or really reduce the interaction of domestic and wild bighorns, domestic sheep and wild bighorns, because of that disease transmission, the pneumonia, you know, that's almost nearly all the time fatal when it happens. And we've done a bunch of work retiring domestic sheep grazing allotments in really key areas. Talk about that nexus up there. Is that a similar issue, or what are the diseases they're looking at that you're
speaking? It's absolutely a similar issue, Aaron. We're concerned primarily with a bacteria called Mycoplasma ova pneumonia. We have done a little bit as an agency. We've done a little bit of preliminary work and have identified that Mycoplasma ova pneumonia is present in sheep and caribou and moose in the state in some limited areas. But at this point, it appears that it's been in the population for some time and was most likely introduced at one point, and maybe it's best to describe it this way. There are a number of strains of this bacteria. Some are more pathogenic, some are more virulent than others, more dangerous. And the strain that we appear to have in Alaska doesn't appear to be particularly bad, but we want to be careful that we don't have additional strains introduced. So we're working hard. Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation is actually taking the lead on that and working with a lot of non-governmental other NGOs and private individuals to work to reduce the possibilities of transmission. But anytime you move animals from one area to another, you always have that risk of what you're taking with you.
Hey, Tom, I think you mentioned to me one time that strain of Mycoplasma ovi in Alaska, you think has probably been here for pretty long time, like well beyond like the current era of concern in the rest of the country.
I think so. Well, I think, you know, it's hard to, let me go back to the evidence, Paul. It appears that the same strain is present in sheep and in caribou and possibly in moose in several different mountain ranges in the state. And that piece of evidence suggests that it was introduced at one point and has spread across several different mountain ranges and herds. So we're not seeing different strains of this bacteria. We're seeing one strain in several different places. So that suggests that it's been around for enough time to spread, but I don't know that we have the ability to say, based on the dispersion, you know, it disperses at this particular rate a year, and we can't really put a time frame on it. But I can tell you that the folks that work on it much more in depth than I do in the lower 48 have concluded that it's most likely not a disease that's endemic to wild sheep. It's been introduced from domestic stock over time. The other real big takeaway there is that where you see it introduced into wild sheep herds, it's a problem because introducing one strain doesn't confer immunity to other strains. So you can have multiple introductions, and the first strain that's introduced might not be particularly bad, but subsequent releases or introductions can be much, much more dangerous. And because Alaska's sheep ranges are so big, you know, the Chugach stretch 300 miles east to west, it's easy to see where that could be a concern, where you have transmission across a long geographic distance, where in lower 48 sheep herds are a little bit more constrained and bounded by development and don't have that potential to spread as widely as quickly.
And that may be a good time for a plug. We sat down with Gray Thornton, president of Wild Sheep Foundation, not too long ago on our podcast, and talked about some of those disease transmission issues. So go check that one out. Paul, you recently went on a sheep hunt. Can you walk us through what, you know, a lot of people don't know what it's like to hunt a doll sheep. Can you just walk us through, you know, getting the tag, getting out there? Do you need to take a float plane? What kind of terrain are you in? You know, I assume you're using, you know, high caliber rifle, like most things, or bows, you know, just walk us through what your hunt was like and bring us there if you would.
Yeah, sheep hunting is, you know, obviously it's the sheep populations, as we've talked about, are in some of the more hard to get to parts of the state. And, you know, in my opinion, and I'm speaking only for myself, the hardest part about sheep hunting by far is just figuring out where there's a legal ram. And once you know where there's a legal ram, then it's just a matter of like figuring out how to get close to them. In my case, I do all my hunting with basically a simple longbow. And so my effective range is like 25 yards max. So that creates some extra challenges there when it comes to sheep hunting. I think that the range that I'm effective is like sheep are pretty wary of foreign animals within that distance. And so they're pretty good at catching you and getting away when you're trying to get close to them. So, you know, you can access sheep country up here via airplane. There's places you can go in on foot. There's places you can go in, people going on ATVs. You know, like I said before, there's a lot of different mountain ranges. Tom's also spent a lot of his life sheep hunting in different parts of the state. And once you find them, you know, the trick for me is to figure out, you know, a particular animal that I want to pursue. Sometimes that takes, you know, weeks or day, you know, matter of days to find. And then, like this year, I found a ram that was an old mature ram. I found him on, I think, the fifth or sixth day of walking around, and I'd covered quite a bit of ground at that point. I was hunting by myself, and I always keep my camp on my back. So wherever I end up each day, wherever I like, you know, end up each day is where I sleep. I sleep in a different place almost every night. And, I found him on, I think, day five or six. And then the next day I got within about 40 yards of him, but couldn't seal the deal. Was seen by a ram and his group. And then I followed them into some kind of escape terrain, some high cliffs, camped as close as I could without being seen. And kind of followed their movements the next day. And, without getting into the whole long thing of it, was able to kind of follow him around until he ended up in a place that seemed conducive to a stock with my type of equipment, and was able over a long time, long slow stock, like literally counting 60 seconds between steps, descending from above. I was able to get 15 yards from him and passed an arrow through his chest, and he fell down 30 yards later. And then the hardest part, the hard work starts when you try to get that animal back to your starting point. But luckily I had my whole camp with me, so I basically just camped where he fell. I got him all in game bags and cooling by dark. And next morning started working them back to my pickup. So yep, that was.
You say cooling too. What, I mean, most people think you're out there hunting sheep in Alaska. I mean, I'm not most people. I'm just showing my own ignorance. You're out there sheep hunting in Alaska. I'm not thinking cooling is probably going to be a huge issue. To talk about that a little.
Yeah. I mean, it's, sheep season typically starts August 10th for the general season hunt in Alaska. And, you know, there's a lot of parts of the state that are still pretty darn warm that time of year. And meat spoilage is a real issue for sure, even at high elevation. And people have all kinds of tricks of, you know, of ways to cool their meat down. When I killed that ram this year, it was getting down into the, I actually had one night, a couple nights before that, where my water actually froze. It was getting into the, you know, mid 40s at night at the coldest, or at the warmest. I mean, so I was able to, I just laid it out on rocks and allowed the meat to cool. Because I knew the next day when the sun came out, it would get pretty hot. And I was, as we all know, all of us hunt here, once the animal's down, the clock's ticking on getting it responsibly back to a place you can cool it and process it. And so, I was a little stressed about that. I actually did at one point submerge it in waterproof bags in the water to kind of cool it down a little bit in a creek. But yeah, that's kind of the process.
And do you have to worry about bears and other things coming in that area when you're camping right next to your kill?
Yeah. I mean, I think in theory you do. You'd have to be. I mean, and a lot of people have had bad experiences. I've been pretty fortunate. I think you have to be fairly unlucky to have a bear come up and get your meat. But I'm sure there's lots of people out there with scary experiences.
Are you knocking on wood when you say that?
I'm not very superstitious, but I am going out deer hunting on Kodiak by myself for 2 weeks in a week. So see what happens.
Well, that's pretty fascinating stuff. And, you know, I think one of the things we wanted to get to is, you know, we're doing a lot of exploration about climate change and how it's affecting hunters and anglers. We've got a series that we're going to kick off here soon. It'll, you know, showcase people from around the country and tell their stories about what they're seeing and how things are changing. And, you know, in some cases, they're pretty dramatic. And I know up north, the climate change issues are really dramatic in a lot of cases. And I wonder if any of you can kind of talk about that and how are those issues. I mean, we've touched on it a little, but those issues are seeming to either compound or, you know, exacerbate some of the things we're seeing with sheep. Can you talk through a little bit about what you're seeing in Alaska in general and, you know, how wild animals are responding and habitat? And any one of you can take that one. Everybody's looking at each other going, who's on this one?
Well, I'll start with it. Just kind of the big picture. You know, assume the world's warming up, let the whole world warm up. Then when it warms up here in the north, it's going to melt the snow earlier and it's going to melt the glaciers. And when you lose that snow, the snow is what bounces the sun's rays back into space. And now that snow has gone, the ground can absorb the warmth. You know, in a lot of places, when the glaciers retreat or melt back, or the snow hasn't melted in a certain spot for a long time, the ground is really dark and it absorbs even more. And then that warms up faster. And then as it warms up faster, more snow melts. So there's almost like a positive feedback that's going on. And the same thing happens in the mountains, which is where the Dall sheep live. And so, you know, where it's warming up the fastest in the whole world really is in the Arctic mountains, the northern mountains, because when the sea ice melts, the sea ice is another thing that melts and it warms up a little bit. And then the sea ice is melting. Then the ocean, instead of reflecting that light back into the sky, the ocean warms up. And then there's more humidity, and then that falls as more snow in the winter, and the sheep struggle with that deeper snow because it's warmer and the humid air holds more moisture, and then the snow is deeper in the winter. And so the sheep struggle, even the moose struggle, and then with the warmth, the bushes get taller and the caribou struggle. And just the last 10 years have seen like remarkable warmth. I mean, for those of us who live here, the summers, every summer is like the summer of the century. Every summer is like so much better than the summer before. Like I remember I lived in the interior of Alaska for about 10 or 11 years up in Fairbanks. And I would come to Anchorage and I would think, what a horrible place. It's just rainy here all the time. Why does anybody live in Anchorage? Meanwhile, all the people in Anchorage were wondering, why does anybody live in Fairbanks where it's so freaking cold? But now the summers in Anchorage are spectacular. I mean, it's like living in California, and there's no mosquitoes. So all this warmth has wiped out the mosquitoes. All this warmth, the mosquitoes are gone. And then so it sounds like it's nice, but then you go out to go hunting caribou and the caribou aren't where they used to be. And you go out to hunt sheep and there aren't as many sheep as there used to be. So it's changing in really rapid ways.
You know, that's an interesting lead in, Roman. You mentioned deeper snow and I'll have to set the stage here a little bit, but you guys remember, in 2012 and 2013, Alaska had two really bad winters. And so I'm gonna just leave that hang for a second. Paul mentioned at the beginning of our discussion that for a ram to be legal, that ram has to be 8 years old or full curl. And if you're a sheep hunter or if you've looked at sheep, you know that their horns grow in a very characteristic pattern. That first year, rams are born in May, and they might put on an inch of horn that between May and November. The horns quit growing during the rut and stop growing through the winter until there's more forage available at Greenup. Then the second year, they grow a little bit longer chunk. and in fact, then they grow in a real predictable pattern. So they put on their most length from 2 to 3. And they put on their most horn volume typically from ages 3 to 4. And then the segments decrease in length. They grow successively less every year. But one of the things that we've been seeing now as the sheep that were born in 2010, 2011 were 2 and 3 years old in 2012 and 2013, a time when they would have been putting their greatest amount of horn growth on, we're actually seeing rams that are 3, 4, 5, 6 inches shorter in horn length than they would have been because of those two hard winters. And they subsequently, you know, heavy winter snow, late spring snowpack persistence. The snow stayed on the landscape for a long time, and they had two really rough years. And you can actually see those years reflected in the horn growth. And that's a real, you know, real in your face, real obvious kind of a short-term consequence to some of these changing weather patterns.
Paul, were you going to chime in? You're shaking your head. I didn't know if you wanted to add to that.
Oh, no, I'm just, I mean, most of my knowledge is anecdotal or just what I've read about things, but the fluctuations in our winters, as someone who makes his living in the wintertime guiding skiing, is and the changes in the vegetation. I mean, it's really notable. And the company that I work for has an awesome photographic legacy of glacial photos, terrain photos that have been taken from the air for the last 23 years now. And just in that short period of time, the amount of usable ski terrain on the glaciers, because the glaciers are kind of falling apart, has changed remarkably. Some of the photos, I can barely believe that they're real, just from 2 decades ago. And then, as both Roman and Tom have mentioned several times, the changes in vegetation, particularly the alders growing taller, thicker, and higher elevations, have significantly altered the terrain map for us. I know that's not directly related to the sheep hunting question, but just anecdotally and observationally, having spent my life here, it's really remarkable.
Snowpack's interesting too, from a direct impact on sheep standpoint. You know, we mentioned it a little bit during some of our preliminary discussions, but it's always been interesting to me that avalanches play such a big role in shaping sheep populations. And when I started working on sheep in 2008, 2009, we had good information on the population. We had summertime surveys, biologists would go out and fly and count the number of rams and ewes and lambs on the landscape, but we didn't know how we were getting there. You know, we'd see 100 ewes on the landscape with 30 lambs. And that was, you know, we had 50 years of that kind of data, but we didn't know the forces that were shaping that. So when we started collaring sheep, it was really interesting to me that avalanches were actually taking a bigger toll on sheep than predators were in my study areas in the Chugach. And that's a trend that's held. What I really would love to know is how does that trend compare to what we had 30, 40 years ago? And as snow density has gotten greater and snow depth has gotten greater, is that a new thing? Is that something else that's coming on? But we're losing annually. We lose more sheep to avalanches than we do to wolves and coyotes and bears and wolverines. All those predators certainly have an effect on the individual. We don't see a population level effect of predation. We do in the Alaska Range, we do in the Brooks, you know, coyotes, wolverines, eagles, wolves all play a role in those areas. But in the Chugach, the predators don't have as big an effect as the weather patterns, the weather factors.
That's fascinating. Go ahead, Rowan.
Yeah, I want to touch on those avalanches too. You know, I don't spend as much time in the Chugach as I do in the Brooks Range, which is the northernmost mountain range in Alaska. And up there, you know, the light changes so rapidly in the spring that they don't really get dry avalanches. They get these slushy avalanches where the whole snowpack kind of goes isothermic at once, and then it just kind of runs down like a big slush, and it's so wet that it'll run right up the other valley side and take out all the trees. And so when you have an avalanche like, I mean, it moves giant boulders, and the snowpack isn't that deep. That's the remarkable thing, but it's just so heavy and saturated that would take out a whole population of sheep. And there's a lot of people who in the spring, not a lot, but there's friends of mine who hike around in the spring, and one of the things they like to do is find where the wolverine have dug dead sheep, you know, out of avalanche cones where the sheep got caught by an avalanche, and somehow the wolverine can sniff it out, and then it just paws down and digs in and then pulls the sheep out to eat, and leaving oftentimes like a beautiful, you know, full curl head up on top because they don't want to eat that. But there's, you know, on the opposite side, like down in the lowlands, and I, you know, I'm not a sheep hunter, and I probably shouldn't even be here, but I do hunt moose. And one of the places I got a moose, it was my secret honey spot for moose. You know, I got a moose there, and it swam out into the lake because I didn't get a good shot, and it swam out into the lake and it died. And then I had to go out in the lake and pull it to shore. And that lake now is all dried up. That lake now is gone, and their moose just graze on grass at the bottom of that former lake bed. And that's common all over the place. So even though it's getting snowier and wetter up high, it's getting drier down low, and these wetlands and lakes are all disappearing. So that's another pretty obvious climate change effect down in the lowlands, is the drying of wetlands and the thawing of permafrost and the draining of ponds and lakes. Some ponds and lakes, they drain because the permafrost in the bottom melts out and then they just drain away. And others just are like on the Kenai Peninsula, where there's not any permafrost really. It's just getting drier and warmer. You know, the precipitation is actually staying the same, but it's getting warmer and they're just evaporating away. So there's a lot happening on the landscape.
Yeah, these are all so interesting. It begs so many questions in my mind. And the, I guess the interesting thing about it too is the effects are so dynamic, right? Whether it's, you know, more rain in one area and it's drier someplace else, or it's too hot over here, or you get a slushy avalanche compared to a powdery avalanche, or, you know, all the different variables that come along with that. And I know, you know, here in Colorado, we're seeing pretty squarely, and it's pretty well documented at this point, 2 to 3 weeks later before snow persists on the landscape, and 2 or 3 weeks earlier that it's melting. And so you can imagine with places, you know, we're in the upper Colorado River Basin, we support where the headwaters for the Colorado River, all that southwestern country, what that means with that precipitation falling as rain in those times and not holding it, and the different effects that has. And then that's just for people. And then you think about wildlife trying to adapt to that. I mean, that's only in 30, 40 years. You know, that's not enough time for evolutionary change. That's not enough time for some of the other change you need to see. Talk a little bit about too, what else are we seeing with, you know, fish anadromous fish are a huge issue with this. I know fish that, you know, need a certain amount of water level to be able to get up to their spawning grounds. Other wildlife, you know, in the north, there's so many kind of iconic wildlife and fish and wildlife that the people think about. And beyond sheep, what are the other wildlife factors that you're looking at along these lines?
Well, I hate to say it because I don't even can't tell one fish from another, but Chinook salmon or king salmon is what we call them up here. They're the iconic animal of the river, like a sheep, you know, like everybody wants to get a king. They taste the best. You know, they're a big fatty salmon that's really big, and their numbers have declined so far that you're not even allowed to keep them anymore in most places. Or, you know, you might used to be able to keep a couple or three or four. Now you can't even, you have to let them all go. And I'm, you know, I'm not a fish biologist, and I shouldn't even, you know, go out on the limb to even speculate, but I think I've heard some talk that the rivers are getting warmed up and the Chinooks aren't doing so well with the warm water now. And I don't really know if that's what it is, but I do know some people have sort of talked about, you know, salmon not liking warm water. Tom, do you know anything about that, or Paul?
You know, a little bit. I know some of my fisheries biologist colleagues were dealing with some fish die-offs up on the Yukon River and some of the Yukon tributaries. I can't pull the numbers off the top of my head, but I know there were some fairly substantial die-offs, and I know that king populations have declined to the point where some of the subsistence fisheries, people living in villages along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers are not able to fish to feed themselves and their families. And it's certainly an issue. I defer to a fisheries biologist on that. Maybe that's something Aaron could corral a couple of my colleagues into chatting about on a future podcast. But it's certainly an issue both with Chinooks, with kings, and with chums too, and other species of Pacific salmon that are really, really vitally important as a food source.
That's, you know, the one thing about talking to scientists is they never want to speak out of turn. but one of the things that we're doing a lot is getting anecdotal stories from hunters and anglers. I mean, enough people now are going, you know, something just doesn't look right here. Or, you know, even 5 or 10 years ago, it just isn't like what it was. And, you know, everybody's a little hesitant, I think, like we all are, to say, no, that's climate change. You know, it's only been 5 or 10 years or whatever. But some of the stuff, you know, I one of the guys I just talked to, he was 100 degrees during his hunting season. You know, he's like, it's never been 100 degrees, never. And now I'm out there in the middle of the day and I got to go home, you know, because it's too dang hot. This is down in New Mexico. And just things like that, you know, that guy's been hunting there his entire life. He's 40 years old, you know, and he's never, ever experienced that. So, you know, I think why we're reluctant, I think it's also worth telling those stories, because especially if you look into the future and you see that different people have all these stories and what the amalgam is of all those things over time, you're going to go, yeah, that corroborates a lot of what we're seeing scientifically. So I think it's important to tell those stories, even if you're not a fish biologist. If you know, it's hard to get a salmon anymore. That's an interesting story and something that the people ought to understand, I think.
Well, I have a little anecdote that if you may, I could add in about caribou and the caribou up in the northwest part of Alaska up by Kotzebue, where Paul works. And it's the Western Arctic caribou herd. It's the biggest caribou herd in the state. Like, you know, it depends, like as many as 500,000 animals in the past. And they migrate about, I think they're one of the farthest migrating animals, you know, mammals, land mammals on Earth. So they walk like 400 miles north and they turn around and walk 400 miles south, and they have to swim 2 giant rivers and cross, you know, 3 mountain ranges. And they had traditional places where they would cross. And there's a group of Alaska natives, Inupiaq, we'd call them Eskimos maybe. And they live along this river, even though the river, you think Eskimos as living in igloos in the glaciers or up, you know, on the ice pack, but these guys don't live on the ice pack. They live in a forested river valley where this big caribou herd goes through twice a year in the spring and in the fall. And they have to swim this river. So there's like 5 villages that hunt caribou by boat, basically. And when they're swimming, and they know these places where they have traditionally crossed. But the last few years have been so warm that I think the shrubs, and you can talk to people up there, like people who've been living their whole lives and hunting and snow machining around in the country, and they will complain about how thick the brush is getting. And the brush has got so thick in places that it's pushed the caribou out of their traditional migratory pathways, and they're not going to where they used to cross the rivers. And now, but the people, some people don't think that it's the bushes pushing the caribou around. They think it's non-local hunters who are up in a different area, people who fly up from Anchorage to go hunt caribou, and they're harassing the caribou. And so the locals want to point the finger at the non-locals, but really it's these bushes that are pushing the caribou around. And because, you know, caribou, they're willing to change their paths. They wander around. But the shrub growth, the bush growth, the willows there are so bad. Like Paul said, I've walked around the state quite a bit, and the worst brush I've seen is down by Cordova on the coast, where the alders are real thick and tall. But the second worst brush I've ever seen, and nobody would ever believe me if I said this, was up in the Brooks Range near the Kobuk River, where the, you know, caribou have those magnificent big antlers that are all like, you know, they got the double shovels, the big bulls got crazy antlers, and they don't want to get all tangled up in thick brush. And so they're going to new places to migrate.
You know, that's a really good lead in, Roman, and it's in truth, it's a food security issue. And, you know, I live in Anchorage. I mean, I love to hunt, and hunting is a really vital part of who I am. And it's a connection with my son and with the land. And we take a caribou every year for meat. And it's a really important thing, but we're not going to starve, you know, but in a village situation, it's a much, much bigger issue, especially when you see the compounding effects of fish not showing up and caribou changing migratory patterns. And it really puts it into context, you know, even though the food is not available in a village situation. You know, you might get one or two barges in the fall, and that's it. It's going to show up before the ice freezes, the river freezes, and you can't get food in. So it's a much, much more pointed issue in those settings.
Yeah, Tom, you know, I work up in Kotzebue, and I'd say like 95% of my patient population there is Inupiaq, or as Roman said, Eskimo people, Alaska Native Indigenous people. And during a lot of the year, I would say that on average, at least once a day, unsolicited, a native elder will mention to me how much the climate is different than it used to be. And they'll usually say it in the context, like you said, of some food source, some subsistent food source, whether it's that the whales are different in different places or more dangerous to pursue, or that the window of time when they can pursue seals in the spring is harder because the ice is going out much earlier or is more precarious. Or that, you know, getting out on the ice for the she fish, which is one of the fish they pursue, is a lot different. And of course, you know, the big one, as Roman mentioned, is the caribou, which is a huge factor, like you said, Tom, that everybody relies on for their food. And, you know, I really do hear about it unsolicited almost every single day working just as a medical provider. I'm not there to talk to them about their diet and their animals, but, I hear about it constantly.
Well, those are important stories to tell. I mean, I think, you know, when people hear the human aspect of it and what it means for, you know, our traditions, our food sources, the wildlife we love, that's when they, you know, it resonates with them a little bit more, and then they can kind of start to understand it or think about it. And it also piques their own interest, I've noticed, where they'll look around a little bit more and go, is that thing that I've been noticing? I wonder what that's about, you know? So, I think that, you know, we're getting near the time that we have here today, but I wanted to give you all a last, you know, chance to touch on anything you think we missed, and thank you for spending the time here, and tell you, you know, we're going to keep trying to explore some of these items and some ways we might be able to continue these conversations and tell more of these stories. And you all have been very helpful on that. And so I appreciate it very much, but I'll let each of you, I'm just going to go around the dial here and we'll start with you, Roman Dial, because we're going to go around the dial and let you just kind of leave us with your parting shot here and would tell us the last thing you want to tell us today.
Yeah. The last thing I'd want to say today is that, things are changing and I they're changing rapidly. And there's a lot of people who, and I was one of them, who didn't think climate change was real for a long time. I thought, no, there's not, it's not. And then I realized it is actually happening. And I have come to the conclusion that it is something that we've done. I know my grandmother didn't think we could pollute the air or the water. But now I think we're polluting the climate. And then there's other people who think there's nothing we can do at this stage. But, you know, the first rule of holes, if you find yourself in a hole, you got to stop digging. So we might not come up with a solution right away, but maybe we should stop digging. And that would be my last point.
Thanks, Roman. Tom?
Boy, I can't think of anything off the top of my head real as profound as what Roman came up with, but you know, it's pretty interesting to see to be able to interact with the collared population of animals that I work on every year and see real direct effects of weather patterns and winter weather and summer weather on body condition, body fat, pregnancy rates, you know, and to see those differences show up every year consistently is pretty striking. It really drives home the importance of how weather patterns do influence wildlife populations and both at the individual and population level.
Thanks, Tom. Paul?
Well, I mean, for me, the impetus to start talking to Tom and Roman and others about this was, like Roman, you know, I was like reluctant to fully accept that this was what was happening and what was causing all the things that I care about to change up here. And I think it's really unfortunate that, you know, the elephant in the room is that this is a pretty political issue. And that's really unfortunate that that's the case. It shouldn't be. It should just be an issue that we all care about, who care about wild places and wild animals and lots of other things. But that's what we're talking about specifically. And so I guess my take on it is just that, you know, like Tom said, there's not like a solution. We're probably not going to helicopter these sheep into a different range or fix things like that. So, you know, if people out there, you really care about the wild places and the wild animals, especially here in the Arctic, the thing to do is to help depoliticize the issue and talk to your representatives and tell them you care about it. And just, you know, that's where we can do something as individuals, but I think really we need legislative change. And I think talking to our representatives and saying like, hey, we care about this and we're hunters and this is important to us is the next step.
Thanks, Paul. And you know, that's what we're aiming to do, really, to tell these stories and to make sure they're not forgotten and to illuminate some of these changes. And you know, whether it be sheep or caribou or salmon, you know, I think we all know that we care enough about those things and they deserve to be here. They belong on our landscapes and we want them to be here forever, right? I mean, hopefully as long as humanity exists, we have those critters. So I appreciate all of you and what you're doing and the insight you've brought to this, and we'll look forward to talking more and thinking on these subjects and figuring out ways we can use them effectively, hopefully to let others know and help get things done that help the issue. So thank you all so much for spending some time with us today, and we'll look forward to talking some more.
We are NWF Outdoors.